The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello! Welcome to the Car Talk edition of Sleep Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I am joined by Anna Szymanski of Michigan.
Yes.
The woman who got her driver's license at the age of never. And I'm also joined by Emily Peck of the Huffington Post, who got her driver's license at the age of,
I think, 40, but maybe it was 42. Unclear.
Somewhere around
there. Recently.
Which makes me the, you know, early adopter when it came to driving, because I was 33, I think, when I got mine. We were obviously jumping into cars at the first available opportunity. We are bad Gen Xers. What can I say?
Really, really bad.
We were meant to be the last generation which cared about cars, and none of us cared about cars.
Yeah. We're very forward-thinking. We're millennial-like Gen Xers.
Yeah, we were ahead of the curve.
Yes.
I think I'm technically a millennial, depending on some some measurements.
I'm saying 1980 is the cutoff.
Okay, then I am.
There you go. All right. So Anna Szymanski is the millennial who never learned to drive.
She's ruined everything.
And she is going to explain to us why General Motors is having to fire 14,000 people because I guess millennials aren't driving. We can go into a bit more detail about that. We are going to talk about the Fed because it was a big Fed week this week. We had a big speech from Jay Powell. We're going to talk a little bit about the Fed, whether it's going to stop raising rates, and what on earth Mr. Trump is doing, talking about all of those, you know, rates all the time. And we are going to have a little bit of fun talking about one of the more meaningless statistics in financial markets, which is which company has the largest market cap. And right now it is down to Microsoft and Apple are fighting it out in a really pointless battle. And because we love pointless battles here on Slate Money, we're going to talk about that. All of that coming up here on Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On Debt, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Debt, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Okay, Anna, as the car expert,
yes,
you can explain to me why is no one buying cars anymore, or specifically, why is no one buying American cars? We had an announcement earlier this year from Ford that they were basically going to stop making all of their cars and concentrate just on trucks and SUVs and crossovers and stuff like that. And now General Motors seems to be doing much the same thing, and they're both seeding the sedan market to the Japanese, who seem to have all of this tied up in a bow. What's going on there?
This past week, CEO Mary Barra of GM announced that the company would be restructuring. They're going to be eliminating a number of plants in the Midwest and in Canada. And the reason they're doing this is because they want to shift from cars to, as you said, crossovers, SUVs, but also autonomous vehicles and electric cars.
So the autonomous vehicles and electric cars thing really has less to do with the factory closings and more to do with this, like, where do we reinvest our profits? They do still have positive cash flow. And rather than trying to invest that money in making more cars or better cars, what they've decided is that The stock market gives car companies very low multiples because they think that millennials don't drive, which they're probably correct about. And so if they want to get their share price up, they need to do sexy things like autonomous vehicles and electric vehicles because they see that Tesla has a very high share price. I think this is all Tesla envy.
I think that this is really GM, unfortunately, making a difficult decision that is probably necessary because Americans aren't buying cars. They're buying vehicles, just to be clear. Like, they're buying SUVs, they're buying crossovers, they're buying trucks, but they're not buying cars.
Well, they're not buying American cars. They're buying the Nissan Altima and the Honda Accord and the Toyota Camry. They're just not buying
The statistic is 2/3 of all new vehicles that were sold last year were trucks and SUVs. 2/3. So they really aren't buying. We really aren't buying cars right here in America. I mean, the parking lots where I live are filled with SUVs and crossovers and trucks, like, no question.
Right. So I think what GM is doing is they're meeting consumer demands. And also, GM is in a little bit of a different position than some of the other auto companies because they have too many plants. And that's part of the reason that they're coming forward with these announcements of complete plant closures, whereas we know Ford's going to be laying off a lot of people. But A, they just haven't been as upfront about it. And B, it's a little different because they don't have so many plants that are just focused on cars.
Well, I mean, the other thing to say is that although GM had a bunch of excess capacity, and a lot of what they're doing here is trying to get rid of excess capacity, because I learned this from my amazing Axios colleague, Joanne Muller, who actually does know about cars. The way you make money in the auto industry is by running auto plants at 100% full capacity, three shifts.
Over 100%, yeah.
and like just churning out the maximum number of cars per plant. And only if you do that can you start really making money. And GM had a whole bunch of plants which were only running one shift and were like really nowhere near capacity. And the basic, you know, widely accepted estimate is there's roughly 3.5 million cars per year of excess capacity in the US. That's how many more cars America could produce than it does produce. And that's just bad for efficiency. So she's closing down all of those plants to try and reduce that excess capacity. But GM only accounts for about 1 million of that 3.5 million. So Ford is the obvious one, as Anna was saying, and they're going to probably close plants as well for exactly the same reason.
Or they probably won't be closing entire plants, but they will definitely be limiting staff.
And the one thing that struck me as disingenuous that she said they want to focus on electric cars they're stopping the Chevy Volt, which
but that's their hybrid, right?
It's a hybrid.
Yeah, and that's
it's
the point.
Apparently a great car.
It's a plug-in hybrid. So,
right, but this is the point, yeah, is that they've been making these half measures. Like, GM has been making these half measures. Oh, we're kind of going to go. It's a hybrid. We're kind of making changes. And what they needed to do was to do something more dramatic, to say, like, no, we are actually changing the face of our company.
Why do they need to do that?
I think they make huge profits on the SUVs and trucks. The margins are like 30, 40%, right? So,
and they lose money on the cars.
And those are big gas guzzling things that they're able to sell here in the United States because we keep the price of gas very low because we're destroying the climate at a rapid pace. And GM coming out and saying stuff about electric cars and autonomous vehicles strikes me as just totally disingenuous.
And let's be clear about
given
this,
where they're making their money.
When gas prices were up at $4 a gallon, that was when Americans started buying cars again, and especially small cars and efficient cars and ones which had good mileage. And the Prius became really popular. Mm-hmm. And now Americans aren't doing that because gas prices are low again. So this idea that, like, it's clear what the trend is, which is that when Americans don't care about gas prices, they like big gas guzzlers. And when they do care about gas prices, that's when they start thinking about fuel efficiency. In a world where Americans don't care about gas prices and buy SUVs and trucks, that's not a world where electric cars are going to be particularly popular, because the main thing that electric cars do is get great mileage and no one cares about mileage.
Although maybe they're thinking, I was speaking to our climate reporter at HuffPost and he said maybe they're thinking about selling electric cars in China, where apparently they're very well subsidized and a growing share of their auto market.
But if you make electric cars in China, you can sell them in China, but you're not going to make them in America.
No, you're not going to make them in America.
No, I mean,
I think they
understand that right now there is not the demand for these products. They know that, and they're making the bet on, like, well, look, we can keep throwing money into products that is a dying part of our industry and where we're losing money, or we'll put money into this other place where we're losing money, but we can but we can see that as an actual growth opportunity, which is unfortunately what the company needs to do.
So explain to me, so electric cars are a growth opportunity because of China, or why?
No, because I think you have a lot of auto companies, the same as like you hear a lot of energy executives talk about the fact that like they realize that despite our, you know, idiot administration, people understand that climate change is a real thing. Throughout the United States, we're obviously seeing it significantly in Europe. We are going to have regulations. There is going to probably be, I mean, at some point, some type of more significant carbon tax. People see in the future, we're not going to have the same type of energy usage as we have now. And they want to get out in front of that.
Yeah, I think this is a timing thing. I think that yeah, you're right. At some point in the long term, there will be more electric cars. And the question is that long term close enough to get a decent sort of ROI on investments that you make today?
No, you're
and
not.
My
you're
question
losing
is, it. Does GM know what it's doing on that front? I mean, they had the Volt. By all accounts, we have this great piece on HuffPost from one of our reporters who lives in Michigan, who wrote about his Chevy Volt and how it's like a great car. It was a good car, but GM never understood its own product, never really marketed it, never really got behind it. You know, these
yeah,
automakers,
now they have an all-electric one
like
called
gas.
The Volt.
They like big, cool gas cars,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That with lots of muscle. And like maybe even if they say, they claim they're going to get into this new area and they see the future coming, I wonder if they can actually handle that future.
I mean, I think it's going to be difficult for all of the large auto manufacturers because they did all come of age where everything was about scale,
yeah,
and bigness and, you know, all of these huge mergers. And now they're not just competing with the big three. They're now also competing with these more nimble companies. And mm-hmm. It looks like that is going to continue in the future, as also you're going to have more competition from markets outside the U.S. So car companies are thinking, and this isn't just GM. This is what's happening everywhere. It's just GM was far more vocal about it.
Mm-hmm. Let's since we're talking about scale and bigness, the other big car related news of late was the jailing of Carlos Ghosn, who was the, let me get this right, the chairman of Nissan, the chairman of Mitsubishi, and the CEO of Renault.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to merge all three of them into this massive global car maker because he was convinced that you need that kind of scale. Fiat Chrysler is another relatively recent car merger, which was predicated on this idea of you need to merge and get scale. I kind of buy this story. If you look at the problems that Tesla has been through, I don't buy this idea that it's like fast and nimble. I think that it is actually hobbled by a lack of institutional knowledge of how to actually manufacture cars at scale. And, you know, Ghosn obviously just overreached massively and everyone hated him. And so there was like this whistleblower in Japan who's like, hey, this guy hasn't reported his income and now he's in jail. And that didn't work out very well.
I mean, people are saying, well, he's kind of like the last of the big personality auto
CEOs. Sergio Marchion died.
Yeah, Sergio Marchion died and like all the other ones are gone.
Yeah.
Mariah Coca comes to mind, but I know that was a long time ago. And now we have someone by comparison, Mary Barra, who's just, it's interesting to see that even as GM is demonized for those layoffs and plant closures, like Mary Barra really isn't demonized. I've been looking at her, the coverage of like her as a CEO versus say like Sheryl Sandberg lately, and just thinking it's interesting like how her personality, Mary Barra, sort of recedes into the background. And as the auto industry seems to kind of also get smaller.
Yeah, I don't think Mary Barra has ever like expressed an interesting opinion in her life.
No, she just...
I'm pretty sure that's not entirely accurate.
She has some anecdotes that she tells over and over again. Like I've heard her speak and she tells like the same story of GM used to have like a very button down kind of a dress code. And I guess when Barra came in, she was like, you know what? I'm changing our dress code now. Just dress the way it makes sense. Like as a dress appropriately was the new code. And I heard her tell that anecdote in like 2015. And then recently I saw a piece in Quartz telling the anecdote again. Like she's just not a very...
Well, that's also how CEOs are coached to give
interviews.
Yeah,
but like, I don't know. I feel like that's not how
she's
car companies
really,
used to have these big personalities.
Oh, yeah, no, and I
CEOs,
definitely agree with
and
that.
And she's sort of like an example of what car companies are now, which is nimble, I guess.
Such a thing as a nimble car company. Although, to be fair, this was the whole idea behind the Fiat Chrysler merger and stuff like that. And increasingly you have these car companies which have global... This is the one time when I feel like you can actually use the word platform and not be a complete douchebag about it. That you basically have... You know, and I'm going to be really technical here, like the engine bits and the wheel bits and the, you know, you put all the cars together like a Lego set, but you can mix and match. And so, you know, the Jeep Renegade is basically the same as the Fiat 500 with a different shape, you know, or, you know, and that kind of thing. And that makes you more nimble, right?
Yeah, like at the dealership, you can sell a bunch of different kinds of cars.
Exactly.
Mean, or at the
plant, and if people want a big boxy car, you sell them Jeep Renegade. And if they want a small, cute car, you sell them the Fiat 500. And if tastes change, you can just change the body shape from one to the other and keep on selling. And that kind of nimbleness comes from scale. It doesn't come from being small.
Right, except that if you're shifting towards electric vehicles, I mean, they involve so many fewer parts. Compared to the internal combustion engine, which is part of the reason that they would involve probably fewer workers. But it's also just, I mean, in some sense, the assembly is much more complicated in terms of, you could argue, the technology behind it.
Yeah,
but in terms of the actual parts,
I mean, it depends whether you include all of the work that goes into making the batteries, because making batteries is...
Right, but the actual assembly of the car was going to be much, it's going to be much more streamlined.
Well, that was what Elon Musk kept on saying, and then he ran into all of these production
problems. That's because he's an idiot.
Wait, should we say why this guy's in jail?
Because he didn't report $44 million of income in Japan.
He just kept it to himself. He was like, we'll get to this eventually.
And then also there were all these stories about how he used a subsidiary in the Netherlands to build himself a house in Lebanon, even though his company doesn't even have any operations in Lebanon.
Yes, correct. And he was only there a few days a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He also had a Marie Antoinette-themed party.
Yes, I saw that.
His second wedding, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah... Don't do that, but also, can we have some, I feel so depressed that the only real visionary in the entire car industry is fucking Elon Musk, you know? We've got to be able to do
better
than that.
I don't know if he's a visionary. He's just good at marketing himself.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if that's entirely true.
Well, he is a visionary. He wants to go to Mars and stuff.
Exactly.
Mary Barrett is never going to come out and say,
little boys in their bedrooms want to go to Mars.
There is a 70% chance that I'm going to go to Mars. I mean, Elon Musk is not going to go to Mars, but he is going to say that there's a 70% chance that he's going to Mars. It makes him a big personality in the car industry. Mary Barrett would never say that.
Yes, it makes him a big personality, but I would argue not a visionary, as I just mumbled. A lot of boys dream of going to Mars. He just happens to be rich, so he can say it to Kara Swisher.
Every visionary car CEO is basically a boy with toys trying to say what would be cool. That's what makes you a visionary in the car industry.
I don't know if that makes you a visionary. No.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay. Talking about visionaries.
And idiots.
We have the classic fight of visionary versus idiot here. We have the man with the crystal ball, Mr. Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, took out his crystal ball and sets interest rates in order to make sure that the U.S. economy can keep on growing and not shrink and keep on creating jobs and all of these other wonderful things. And he uses the combined power of all of the Fed's forecasters to do this. And he reckons that, we're still not quite at neutral rates yet, but the economy is ticking along quite well. And basically, he seems to be doing an okay job, except there's this weird orange Cheeto thing in coming in from stage left and making the whole thing much more complicated. What is going on, Emily?
Well, Jay Powell at the Fed is trying his best to just go about his business. And the President Trump just keeps trash talking him, basically saying he's not happy with him, saying he should stop raising rates, saying something, I'm not being accommodated by the Fed because I know in my gut, that's what the president just wants to rule with his gut. He knows that he should not be raising rates anymore and breaking a long tradition of presidents not messing around with the Fed.
It's not
just to be clear,
that long.
Yeah, just to be clear,
kind
like
of long-ish.
It's long-ish.
No, it's, I mean, this is actually like, okay, look, here we all hate Donald Trump. We all think Donald Trump's an idiot. Donald Trump breaks norms all the time. This is not norm breaking. If you look at when the Fed like kind of became independent in like 1951, since then, pretty much almost immediately, every president tried to affect Fed policy. You know, whether you're talking about the most famous example that everybody says of Nixon and Arthur Burns, or whether you're talking about like Lyndon Johnson, like literally shoved William McChesney Martin against a wall and screamed at him.
And so, that was a long time ago, though. I mean, the last
president. So did George H.W. Bush. He said it
George
while he was.
H.W. Bush did not shove anyone against
the wall.
He did not
shove any. He did not lay his hands on. No. But he, while he was president and after he was president, talked quite a bit about his that he did not agree with Fed policy. So I think that this is one instance where I think we are blowing Trump's actions a little out of proportion.
Well, no, we are
not.
Okay,
so
there's, but every other president, in general, when presidents have been unhappy about Fed policy, they have, you know, tried to buttonhole the Fed chair and say, "Oi, you, stop making me look bad, stop raising rates." As far as anyone can tell, Trump hasn't done that. He hasn't talked to Powell at all. He just gives interviews to the Wall Street Journal where he talks about how unhappy he is with Powell. Like, there's a difference. I think there's an important difference between saying something directly to the Fed chair and trying to influence Fed policy that way, which I think is actually not what Trump is doing and what was done in the past, versus what Trump is doing, which is coming out in public and trying to make his supporters not trust the Fed and turn the Fed into an enemy of the people and basically reduce the public trust in the central bank, which I think has not been done by previous presidents.
Well, although you had, I guess it just depends. I mean, yeah, to a certain extent, I'll give you a little bit of that, but you're talking about Nixon trying to like actually looking into actually diluting the power of the Fed, actually affecting Fed. I mean, he actually affected Fed policy. So yes, we can make the argument that Trump is doing more of this in public, but he's being less effective than previous. So if the point is that we want an independent Fed, I would almost rather have some just idiot saying things than people who are actually using like their power, or like Nixon planting false stories in the news
Fed independence is a means to an end. There's a reason why we want an independent Fed, and it's not just because independence in and of itself is a wonderful thing. The reason why we want an independent Fed is because that's the best way to make sure that the public trusts the Fed to do the right thing. And what Trump is doing is he's doing an end run around that, and he's trying to create mistrust of the Fed even with independence.
The reason we want an independent Fed is so that investors know that there is a check on government policy. There's a check on fiscal policy. You can't just have the monetary policy being used as a political tool. That is extremely important.
I disagree with that. I think the reason for an independent Fed has nothing to do with investors. It has nothing to do with markets. It has everything to do with just keeping the broader economy on an optimal footing as best we can without political interference. And, you know, logically that's probably good for markets, but that's a consequence. That's not a cause.
I think we see this all the time in a lot of the countries we wind up talking about, how crucial it is to keep monetary policy away from politics, and how when it gets tied up together, disaster occurs.
Yeah. I mean, like,
and to talk about Nixon and say, well, this has precedent. I feel like that was quite a long time ago. And I mean, there was a piece in the Journal from Nick Timiraos, and I think he said the last time a president tried to get involved with the Fed was maybe Clinton in 92, and he was talked out of it. And since then, there really hasn't been, it really has been more independent. I think also it seems like Trump is, he's not just like trying to publicly put pressure on Jay Powell to keep rates low. He seems to be setting him up to be kind of like a scapegoat for when the economy goes south.
Right. Although I would also, I don't anyone want to sound like I'm defending Donald Trump. Like, yes, he's an idiot. Everything he says is stupid. But I just feel like we're being a little naive about how presidents have affected.
Well, no, but to Emily's point, let's think about this in terms of chronology, right? That Nixon was just a few years away from when the central bank had no independence at all. Like, there wasn't this norm, this global norm of central bank independence.
It's been a little while.
Nixon. It had been, you know, maybe 10, 15 years, something like that.
Closer in time than we are to Nixon.
Right. But
And closer in time than we are to Clinton, you know?
Yeah.
And so the, you know, he was still trying to push things around and see, you know, see how much influence he could have. And as the years and the decades have gone on since then, and as central banks around the world have gained independence, and as you've had like the ECB and other central banks really become part of the global monetary architecture, the idea of questioning central bank independence and trying to influence the central bank has become much more of a much stronger norm. So what Trump is doing here is he's violating a norm which is much stronger now than it was back in Nixon's day.
Back in Nixon's day, yes, I'll agree with some of that. Although I would also argue that, like, Alan Greenspan has come out and say, like, he was every president constantly tried to influence him. So I guess that's where I'd say, like, yes, I do think the public nature of it is different. I mean, I'll give you that. But I think the actual actions just aren't that different.
No, and I think, you know, as I say, I think I can kind of agree with you on the influence. I don't think he is going to influence Powell. I don't think he is going to influence the Fed. If anything, he's going to, at the margin, force Powell to keep on raising rates, even if he doesn't really want to, just to prove that he's independent.
But I heard he's probably going to raise rates again in December. And then after that, it's a question mark.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, I know there's zero evidence that Powell has been influenced. I mean, as though there could be like some smoking gun evidence of that. But it is kind of curious.
That's going to have to do with like shifts in data. And also a lot of this has to do with the fact that Powell messed up. And he said in a previous statement that we were far from neutral.
Right.
And that spooked the market. So a lot of this is just face saving. Like, I don't think anybody really thinks, unless the economy really turns, that the Fed's going to change their trajectory.
So here's the question, right? Is right now we're getting, according to Powell in his latest speech, very close to neutral. There'll be another rate hike this year. Mm-hmm. And then, as you say, we don't really know what's going to happen in 2019. But let's say, for the sake of argument, more or less, that we go into 2019 with neutral or close to neutral monetary policy. At that point, the Fed basically has two choices in terms of future actions. If it thinks the economy is overheating and, you know, inflation is growing too fast and, you know, the economy is like too hot, then it can raise rates to try and put the brakes on. If it is worried about recessions and economy slowing down, then it can cut rates to try and keep the expansion going. My personal feeling is that the risk of a recession is probably higher than the risk of the economy overheating. So in that sense, maybe this rate hike cycle might be coming to an end.
It's possible. I mean, I think that we are in a little bit of uncharted territories, because a lot of people talk about like R-star, the kind of neutral rate. And, you know, you have people like who are saying it may be lower than it was in the past because of globalization and the internet and many, many other things of why it, and just aging population, why it could be that rates will not have to be go quite as high in order to be neutral.
Because right, inflation's
side the question of where the neutral rate is. Let's just say, assuming that we're at or near the neutral rate right now, the question then becomes, what happens after it's neutral? Do rates go up or do they go down?
I mean, my guess is they would probably just remain stable for a little while unless things markedly change. And that's also another reason why you don't want rates to be at zero. So then if there was a recession, your kind of toolbox is a little limited. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people probably do think that it has been so long since we've had like a big inflation issue that I think a lot of people kind of forget. And we have had a relatively tepid economic recovery. So I think it does seem like the likelihood of the Fed overreacting is probably higher. And granted, if you actually
wait, when you say overreacting, you mean raising rates
maybe too quickly. And I mean, I do think it's interesting if you just look at like the history of the Fed's actions, especially like the kind of modern Fed, like post 1950, that they always make a mistake. Like no matter what the Fed does, they will do something wrong. They're, you know, far better than any alternative we have. But I'm sure they'll either...
In general, the Fed's mistakes have been that they cut rates. They were too accommodative. Like this is the big Greenspan era is that right. He... you know, cut rates too far too quickly for no, especially like in the early 2000s for mm-hmm. no good reason, mm-hmm. Just because he wanted to keep the stock market up or something. No one really understood why he was so aggressive about cutting rates in the early 2000s. And that caused the credit bubble, which caused the financial crisis. And in terms of raising rates, you know, the big one that everyone remembers is Paul Volcker, mm-hmm. like raising rates to 20% or whatever the hell he raised them to. And everyone gives him a huge amount of credit for that. Well, no one said that was an error.
Right. I mean, no, because that was no one says that was an error. But if you having said that, what often happens is that the Fed tends to overreact to whatever happened previously. And so the it's never perfect. And I'm not saying that they're going to cause a massive recession. I'm just saying that, like, yeah, are they going to be perfect? Probably not. But I do think that it seems like, you know, Powell is pretty reasonable. And I don't think he's overly hawkish. I don't think he's overly dovish. I think that they're pretty much just.
Of course,
I think Janet Yellen would have been better, but apparently she was too short to continue.
This is the ridiculous thing, is that with Trump complaining that Powell isn't dovish enough, like if he wanted a dove at the Fed, he could have just kept Yellen.
Right, but he got rid of her, I mean, purely because she didn't look the part. I really think, and also I guess he wanted a change from whoever Obama picked, but the Washington Post did have this like delicious detail this week that he was thinking about keeping Yellen, but he went around and saying to people, she's 5'2". What kind of Fed chair could be 5'2"? She's too short to do the role.
Welcome to Trump land.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Okay, so let's talk about this ridiculous metric. Emily, as the sort of like, you know, sensible person around this table.
The one who didn't prepare for this conversation because I didn't realize we were having it. I'm ready.
No, but this is exactly why you're perfectly placed to answer this question. Why do any normal people care about market capitalization? Like, why is this a metric that, you know, the press and even the Huffington Post will write about on a regular basis? What is it about market cap that captures the imagination of people? It's like the only financial jargony metric term thing that people seem to care about a lot of the time.
Okay, well, setting aside that you've just set me up as like the village idiot over here, I'm going to explain that people like recognizable brands. So we would only cover like market cap gets really big if it's a company you've heard of. Everyone's heard of Apple. Everyone has Apple products in their pocket or their purse. So they care about Apple and how much it's worth and all that kind of stuff. It's like a person. Brands are like people to people. And market cap is kind of like an easy thing to wrap your head around. This company is worth this amount of money and this company that you maybe hate is worth this amount of money. It's like a race or like a football score or something.
And in general, higher is better?
I mean, isn't that how money works, you guys? I don't know. You tell me. Like, yeah, higher is better.
Anna, is higher better? Is market cap something which, like, higher is better? Because I really don't think it is.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I mean, I think it depends on what you mean by that. Like, who are you for the company, for the investor?
For anyone.
Like, yeah, I mean,
so for investors, it's clearly not. I mean, what we have right now, the news hook here is that Microsoft may or may not at some point around now be overtaking Apple in market cap and become the most valuable company in the world.
I will add that this is interesting because Microsoft was supposed to be kind of like a dead tech firm and Apple was supposed to be the cool tech firm. So it's almost has like the whiff of like an underdog or a comeback story. And
there is
people
a comeback.
Yeah. Love a comeback
Microsoft
story.
Hasn't had a higher market cap than Apple since basically the iPhone took off.
Yeah, exactly.
But the way and also another company which is rising up the market cap league tables is good old fashioned Cisco. You know, which like remember them from mm-hmm. 30
well,
years
and
ago.
Plus, people hate the. Sorry, one more thing. People are in this place right now where we hate all these newfangled tech. And we hate Facebook now. We hate Twitter now, right? We, for some reason, probably hate Apple, too. They're all bunched together. So it's kind of fun, since everyone's hating on those companies, to go back and be like, remember the good old days when these other tech companies were running stuff?
But I think that this is actually important, because I think part of the reason that Microsoft is doing as well as it is because they have focused on enterprise solutions. Like, they're focusing on the kind of boring business side.
Okay, but this is Slate Money. We don't use the phrase enterprise solutions on Slate Money. I'm sorry. That's just not something we do. But no, okay, first of all, I'm not going to let you get away with that. What
Harsh.
Is an enterprise solution?
They're focusing on cloud computing, on servers.
Dear. Yeah, you see, it's all jargon. Well, I don't understand any of
everyone
this.
Everyone knows about the cloud. It's the cloud.
Yes,
it's out
exactly.
There.
So
the
companies don't have to have their own servers. They're on Microsoft 365 being like through the internet. I mean, this is where Microsoft is. Cloud computing is pretty much what they have staked everything on, that and AI.
Okay. So the...
What about the blockchain?
They're not doing blockchain. But the... The way you get big, the way you increase your market cap, if you're Cisco or if you're Microsoft or virtually any of these big companies, but not, interestingly, Apple, is you grow via acquisition. You know, you're Microsoft, you buy GitHub, you buy LinkedIn, you buy Skype, you buy Minecraft, you know, you buy Nokia, you know, anytime there's some like interesting business you want to get into,
Nokia
you just
wasn't
buy that.
The smartest purchase.
But in any case, growing via acquisition, it will increase your market cap. It does nothing for your share price, right? If what you care about is your shareholders and trying to create shareholder value or whatever, market cap is kind of not important. And so that's one of the interesting differences, I think, between Microsoft and Apple, is that Apple never really cared that much about market cap. It, you know, did care about the share price, and it tried to become very profitable and did and made lots of money, and the share price went up and became valuable. Never traded at enormous multiples, but was valuable all the same. Whereas these other companies which have been floating, you know, sticking around for a long time, like Microsoft and Cisco and Intel, which are still huge today, are largely huge because they grew via acquisition, which didn't, you know, it's kind of a cheat in
a way.
But
Microsoft's like stock price has done quite well.
So yeah, that's the other thing. Microsoft is trading on a much higher multiple than Apple is. That Microsoft is not nearly as profitable as Apple. It has lower revenues, lower profits, but it's worth as much because it's managed to get this recurring revenue from large corporations with this cloud services and whatnot. So every month it gets massive checks from S&P 500 companies or Fortune 500 companies. And that that kind of certain revenue with super high margins is exactly what the stock market loves. And that's why, you know, Salesforce is worth so much money. That's why Oracle is worth so much money. And that's why Apple has never been worth that much money, because it doesn't have that kind of predictable recurring revenue from corporations. It's just trying to sell gadgets to individuals.
Well, I think Apple, in a way, is a riskier business. It depends. I mean, if people stop buying iPhones, what is Apple left with? The iTunes store?
Well, no, I mean,
I just don't. Right. What else does it have? I actually kind of think it's a fun story if the companies are personalities to watch, because, yeah, Apple, I don't know. This can't last forever.
This is actually important. That, I mean, Apple gets like 60% of its revenue from the iPhone, and they've announced that they're no longer going to be releasing the the count of individual units sold each quarter, clearly because they're not going to be selling as many. So, and they're not doing as well overseas. And this is a big deal because they're talking about shifting more and more into services. That is what everyone's now saying about Apple. But, you know, one really wonders, like, are they really going to have a competitive advantage in, like, the
what
iTunes
services?
Like Apple Pay, iTunes, the App Store.
No.
Like, I mean, these are where...
And we should say there is a big antitrust lawsuit happening against Apple right now, which we're going to cover when we get a verdict, which is basically saying, you know, insofar as it's making a bet on taking its 30% cut of everything in the iTunes store, that could be illegal.
And it only works, again, if they keep selling those iPhones, because if everyone switches
No, that's not true. I mean, if... So long as people keep their iPhones, they will keep on buying things on the iTunes store. They in order for that revenue to go away, they'd not only need to not buy new iPhones, they'd need to actually buy a new phone that wasn't an iPhone.
Yeah.
And I think that most people with iPhones generally stick with iPhones.
Yes, but I don't think that lasts forever. We've never seen any product last forever in that way, right?
Although I think, given what's given that there are only two mobile operating systems, which are iOS and Android, and given that Android is part of this sort of privacy problematic skeevy Googleverse where they mine a whole bunch of data, and like Tim Cook has been very clear that they have left a lot of money on the table by not invading your privacy and not selling your data and that kind of thing. I think over the long term, that's good for iOS, and that's a good reason for people to stick with iOS.
My thinking is maybe not as logical, but I'm like, Anna mentioned Nokia earlier, and you know, everyone used to have a Nokia. Everyone used to have a Motorola Razr. No one saw the iPhone really even coming. So
right.
One day there's going to be a new thing that comes that no one saw coming that is going to
possibly,
and
that
if
was,
you also,
that
day
was
might be in 20
work.
Years.
But I think
don't know.
I think that was the genius of the iPhone. It's that, like, back when Nokia was the huge brand in phones, it was the manufacturer of physical handsets, and you bought the Nokia flip phones because they were cool. The Motorola flip phone because it was cool. And now, and for the foreseeable future, every phone is exactly the same black rectangle. No one is buying it because this black rectangle is cooler than that black rectangle. It's all about the operating system. That's the only thing that matters.
Tell that to Microsoft, which everyone said would always be powerful because it didn't matter what computer you bought, you would always buy Microsoft software. But that, too, came to an end with the introduction of the iPhone and everyone moving to, the cloud. So, like, tech changes. No one ever sees it coming,
right.
And
I think
products
you're right.
Lose their monopoly.
And I also think we should look outside of just the U.S. market, because Huawei and a lot of Chinese competitors are doing quite well. Like, people outside of the U.S. do not necessarily want to spend the money on an iPhone when they can get a less expensive phone with a lot of great features.
Sure, but Huawei is Android, basically. You know, it's ultimately going to come down to iOS versus Android. And Android has always had much, much higher market share than iOS, and always will. I don't think that's going to change. The question is, can Apple continue to sell iPhones at $1,000 a pop and keep its profits up that way? And it's a good question, because, like, do we really need, like, isn't technology meant to be something which comes down in price? The iPhone is the only piece of technology that I can remember that has actually got more expensive over time.
Because that's the only way they can keep making the same amount of money on it if they're selling fewer iPhones.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, let's have a numbers round. Emily, what's your number?
My number is $20,000.
$20,000.
Dun, dun, dun.
What's that?
That is sort of like the most a Santa Claus can make in a year. There was this great piece on Vox.com, everyone should go read, all about what it takes to be a high-end Santa. Yeah, you have to have a real beard, and it costs like several hundred dollars to get it dyed white during the season, a few thousand for the whole costume and everything. It can be a very serious business and jolly.
And then you make $20,000 in what, the space of a couple weeks?
I guess it's a few months. I mean, the one Santa they interviewed, he works as a Santa all year round. It's corporate parties and everything.
It's a lot
he's iconic.
And $20,000 is how much he makes
all year?
Yeah, that was sort of they said their estimate, Vox's estimate was like 10 to 20 is how much you could make.
Per what?
Per year, but most of it's in the season.
Right.
So Santa needs a second job.
So he's not like a full-time Santa.
It's not, if you're thinking of like, I'll just quit and become a Santa, probably don't do that. That's not enough money.
But is it a good excuse to like eat a lot and grow a belly?
Yes. And like grow a cool beard and stuff. Yeah. I guess a lot of the problems, some of the Santas can't grow, like it comes in patchy, so that's an issue. And then there's debate over what kind of fake beard to get. Human hair is obviously the top. And then there was other ones listed.
Talking about bizarre facial hair, my number is $100,000, which is the fine that DJ Khaled is having to pay to the SEC for pumping crypto scams on his social feeds. He's also having to give back another $50,000, which is how much he got paid for pumping crypto scams on his social feeds. And Floyd Mayweather is having to pay a $300,000 fine and pay back $300,000. So, you know, they're finally cracking down on crypto scammers like DJ Khaled.
Meanwhile, I just read Equifax didn't have to pay any fines for that big hacking thing that happened.
Do you think that Marriott is going to have to pay fines for releasing 500 million pieces of data about like every single person who's ever stayed in the Starwood Hotel?
Probs not.
Probs not.
But we got DJ Khaled, so...
All is right in the world. My number is 7.83%. That's the coupon on the UniCredit bond.
Oh, my God. I'm so glad that we've got a bond coupon.
Yes. So UniCredit's an Italian bank. Sold this bond this week to a single buyer, which pretty much everybody knows is PIMCO. And this is significant because in January, when they issued a very similar type of debt instrument, the coupon was 1%. So this just shows you, kind of going off of actually what we talked about last week, like how bad things are getting in Italy and how the debt markets are really, really suggesting that there is a lot of problem in the financial system of both the sovereign, the banking system, corporates and individuals.
And you know there's a problem in the bond system when you start seeing a coupon which has like 2 decimal places on it. Like, no. Coupons are always round numbers.
No. Well, it depends. I mean, like 8.3, but like you have like, you know, 3/4, an eighth. There's lots of like...
Yeah, sometimes it's like a half or an eighth. Often it's just a round number, but 7.83%?
Yeah.
Yeah, like what you would normally do would be like put it at 7.5%, so at a discount. But no, 7.83% coupon, you know there's something wrong. Okay, I think that's it for us this week, except for you lovely, lovely Slate Plus listeners. If you're a lovely Slate Plus listener, we will talk about what happens to pay gap data when you include the fact that a lot of women just often spend years not working at all.
Or working part-time.
That's in Slate Plus, but otherwise, many thanks to Max Jacobs for producing the show this week. Keep on emailing us on slatemoney@slate.com, and we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.